And he's on it.
A.J. Foyt has won his fourth 500-mile race.
It's a drag race. Marco Andretti, Cornish, who's going to win? At the stripe, it's home.
Goodyear makes a move. Little Al wins by just a few tenths of a second.
You just don't know what Indy means.
More Front Wings Centennial Interview Series.
Hello and welcome again to More Front Wings Centennial Interview Series. Today we're speaking with two-time winner Ari Leyendijk. From 1985 to 2002 in Ari's 17 starts, he of course netted those two wins in 1990 and 97. He also had three pole positions in 93, 97, and 99, and is 31st all-time in the laps led category with 187, and 6th all-time in the laps completed with 2,957 laps. Ari, let's just start by talking about your rookie year in 1985. Can you think back to that year and give us what your impressions were first arriving at the Speedway and going through that month of May?
Well, first of all, you know, the track is quite big, and I was there for the first time in 84 as a spectator. And I was a little bit awestruck. Actually, it was the second time I was there. The first time was in 81 when I just came to the United States to drive in the Super V series, and we took the tour bus around the track, and the thing that struck me the most was how long the straightaways were and how narrow the track was, and I really couldn't imagine driving around that place at those kinds of speeds that they were doing. And so yeah, I have a lot of memories of just going there the first time, driving there the first time, and the first year I drove there in 85 was quite intimidating. And you know, it was a lot different back then than it is now, where, you know, personally I help rookies these days that drive there for the first time, and I give them a lot of pointers, and I tell them what to watch for and what to be careful about and how to react to what they feel that goes on with the car, their instincts. But back then I just showed up there without any coaching or guidance whatsoever. We had a rookie orientation test. And we got a few tips from some of the veteran drivers, but really our team was green behind the ears. My engineer had never been to Indy, and the crew chief, and nobody had been to Indy as far as competing there. So we were really, you know, learning a lot during the month of May, but it just got better and better and better, and I started to like the track more and more.
Well, you, of course, had your first victory in IndyCar racing at all in 1990. Can you go through your memories of that month as well?
Yeah, by that time, obviously, I'd been there 5-6 years with several teams, with Hemelgarn, Dick Simon, and Provimi Racing. And especially with Dick Simon Racing in 88 and in 89, we had really good cars as far as handling goes. We were a little bit down on horsepower against the Chevy Ilmor engines. So when we went back in 1990 and I was driving for Doug Shearson Racing, the thing that we did have then that we didn't have those previous years was the Chevy Ilmor. And not that the engine is the most important thing, because the car has to handle as well, but we happened to really get our car working really well and qualified third. And during the weeks leading up to the race, practicing on full tanks, high half tanks, and just all kinds of different race setups, my car was really, really good, and I was going into that race really confident, and it proved, because obviously we won the race, but it wasn't something that surprised me. I was actually, just before the start of the race, I was being interviewed, and they said, "What do you think your chances are?" And I said, "Well, I think I'm going to win," and that's what we did, so. So, yeah, it was a great month. I mean, the whole thing couldn't have gone any smoother. So it was perfect. And you always need a little bit of luck in that race. Several guys that have won the race had everything going for them, kind of lucked into it. Some other guys got unlucky, and that's how the Indy 500 is or was. These days, it's a little bit different. The cars are so evenly matched. It's a whole different game these days.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Ari, let's move forward a little bit and talk about 1996. You talked briefly about 1990, and of course you set the record for the 500 miles that still exists. You claim the other two records that people really talk about are still the one and the four lap records. Can you talk a little bit about the speeds that year and what was it like just driving at those speeds that you were at in 96?
Well, I always enjoyed going really fast at Indy. I mean, there's something about, you know, really putting together a great lap, which was very exciting for me to do and work on the car and get the car balanced and then get the car trimmed out and find more and more speed as you reduce the downforce on the car and really looking for that limit and getting the most out of the car was always something that I enjoyed very much. I know some guys that don't really enjoy going to the limit that much, but I guess that's why Indianapolis was my specialty, so to speak. 96 was amazing because the car that I had was a Reynard, and the car was just really good. And then my engineer, Tim Wardrop, was really at the peak and the top of his game, and we really worked well together. What happened that year is the speeds were so high because there were a couple of reasons. The track had just been resurfaced. The rumble strips, which had been in place at Indy since 1993, they had been removed, and that piece of racetrack became available, which wasn't available before, which was about maybe a foot or a foot and a half on the inside of the turns. That helped. And then the fires on tires were just so much better than the Goodyear tires. And the tires were so good, and they had so much grip, and they lasted also very long. So you could run longer on them at higher speed than was possible on the Goodyears at the time. And I think that's one of the reasons Goodyear pulled out of IndyCar racing, because it's just they weren't in the same league. But anyhow, those three factors led to these really high speeds. Of course, the record still stands today, and I believe they want to break it, which would be fine by me. I think records are there to be broken, not to be there forever. So I hope they can do it in the near future. It would be fun to watch.
When Roberto Guerrero set his record in 92, his one of his four lap records, he said at the time that when he was going 232, when he set those records, he said it was much easier to go 232 than to go 225 that year, just because of how good the car had to be. Did you find that similar sensation in 96?
Well, the thing is with these high downforce cars that if you go slow, the car feels kind of funny and not settled. So as you increase the speeds and the downforce really starts to work on the car settles down, everything becomes a little bit more quiet, and everything seems like the car seems planted. But I think 225 or 232, that's not such a big difference. Really, if you're driving around at 205, for instance, just getting warmed up, the car feels not so good. But then as you increase the speed, it's almost like, you know, that's when you tell the rookie drivers as well, okay, you know, the car doesn't feel really good now at 210. But if you just keep your foot in it a little bit more and a little bit longer, it will start to feel better. And it sounds really strange to a person without a lot of experience, but it's just getting over that hump, and then all of a sudden he'll feel, yeah, okay, it does feel better. But coming back to speeds, I mean, speed is a number. Really, we went so fast in 96, and then the following year, the Indy Racing League introduced the new cars with the non-turbo engines, the normally aspirated engines. And in 97, so the year after, I was on pole with 218 against to the 237 the year before. And really, the 218, for me to do the 218 in that car was much harder and more nerve-wracking than the 237 was in the Reynard, because the car just wasn't completely right as the other car was. So the level and the speed number, the higher it is, it doesn't mean the more difficult it is at Indy. It doesn't mean that at all. Sometimes in the race, the car goes away and the car gets loose and the car gets really unstable and you're doing 202 miles an hour and you're so much off the pace and you're scaring yourself. So I guess to kind of put that in a nutshell, the faster you go, you know the guy's comfortable.
You touched on this a little bit, but just let's see if asking this brings out a little bit more detail in your mind. When you think back to setting those records in 1996 and the fact that you have held those records in Indianapolis for 15 years after a period where records were being broken over and over and over again, what's your opinion on the fact that you have done so over such a period of time?
Well, what happened was in 1996 when those speeds were attained, I think that the safety issue came into play where that same year during practice session, Scott Brayton was killed.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, in 1992, a driver was killed, but he was actually Joe V. Marcello. He just had a really unfortunate accident where during warm-up laps, he lost control, he spun out on cold tires and hit the wall and was killed as well, and that was in 1992. And I think that, this is kind of a guess, but maybe insurance companies have something to do with it. But, the speeds were reduced in 97, and then they started creeping back up again, and then they hit 230 plus maybe in 2002, I believe. And then the rules were adapted again. So really it's not been a matter of we want to go out and break the track record. No, we want to go out and make sure we don't run too much above 225, 226, 7.8. I think now the curtain has been lifted again and said, okay, you know what, we want to go out and break that record. And I believe, especially next year, in 2012, when the IndyCar Series run the turbocharged engines, and I believe with that package, it should be possible to do that. And they could do it just for qualifying, and then they could reduce the boost for the engines for the race again and go back to somewhat slower speeds, but they could increase the boost to the point where, they could reach 238 or so.
So just to reiterate then, your opinion is that was the right thing to do. So what is it that you feel has changed that makes it a valid thing to approach now?
Oh, well, that's just an idea that the moment they introduced the new rules package for next year, for 2012, with the turbo package, it's when I said, well, this could be a time for them to break the record if the IndyCar Series wishes to do so. And that means if they can, get away with it as far as insurance policies, et cetera, et cetera. So Randy Bernard suggested it, and he thinks it's a great idea to do that next year. So, I've never been against the high speeds, because the high speeds were just a part of my career. I always enjoyed them. The fact that they didn't have those high speeds, well, the cars that they had for the longest time didn't allow them to do those speeds, and then when they did get closer, they tuned down the engines again. So clearly the league didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But now it looks like they want to do it. So my opinion is if they can go fast, just go fast. That's just the name of the game. I like to see records broken, so I'm hoping they will.
And Ari, when you were driving the 96 at those very high speeds, did you ever have a sensation that maybe we're getting beyond what the limit of a driver's capability is, and it from a driver reflex and evasive action standpoint, that we need to slow it down a little bit?
No, I think the drivers have a very good sense of what their car is doing while they're going around the racetrack. So the driver senses, okay, the car now is capable of going, a bit more faster, so actually making certain adjustments, and then you go faster. I mean, the reaction time of the drivers is really fast, and I think at those speeds, it was never a problem for me. I never drove around thinking, boy, I'm going too fast. The only thing that I was thinking was, boy, I hope I don't hit the wall because it's going to be a big crash. But at a lower speed, the crash is big, too. I mean, the crash is always big, anytime you're traveling over 200 miles an hour, you're going to have a big crash. So, I don't think the drivers have a problem keeping up with higher speeds. I think at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, at that particular track, no. But if you would go to a track like Texas, you might remember the Champ cars being there, and they canceled the race because a lot of drivers were getting dizzy
mm-hmm.
and disoriented. That's because they were actually traveling too fast for what their bodies and their brains could handle. So the G-forces were just simply too high. So it depends on the racetrack. But for Indy, I think you could run around there at 240 and that wouldn't be a problem. In fact, we almost did in 96. I think I ran 239.2. I had a little bit of help of a car in front of me with a tow, but...
A little bit?
Quite a bit, actually. It was too bad if we didn't have a little bit more tow on the other back straight than on the other straightaway. It would have been kind of cool to say, yeah, I did 240 average, but now it was 239. So, always drivers always want to go faster and have more, I guess.
You always need just that little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's get back to talking about your race victories and move on to 1997. We talked a little bit about the change in formula that year, and obviously you're running under the new Indy Racing League banner in 97 compared to 1990. Talk a little bit about that month. And if you could, it was rain-delayed race. It was delayed for a couple of days, so you had to wait around for that. And then we had a very strange finish at the end with the green and white flag. If you could talk about that month of May and specifically kind of what you remember about the race and how it ended up there.
Well, the month of May went very smooth for us. I think we were pretty much myself. You know, I was quickest almost every day on the racetrack and pole position. I got pole position on qualifying day. Just a hair a little bit faster than Tony Stewart, and it was it turned out to be quite a battle between Tony Stewart and myself, but in the end we almost lost everything in the race, because of the situation with the white, yellow, and green flag. It was very confusing, but, the race went really well. I mean, it went kind of according to plan. I was leading the race and I would come into the pits, but then we had a problem with the air jacks and the car wouldn't come up in the air, and it delayed our first three pit stops. And each time I came in, I would come in as the leader and go out in second or third place. So I asked the crew politely to fix the problem and, you know, let's try and get it okay the next time, because I'm driving my butt off here every time to get the lead, and then every time I come in the pits I lose it. So we had a little bit of a discussion back and forth. But the first day was completely rained out on Sunday. And then on Monday, the day after, we only ran, I believe, 20 laps or so. And then on Tuesday, of course, we finished the race. So, yeah, it was a pretty long race weekend. And I felt bad for the fans that they had to keep going away and come back again. That was, I think, the worst part of it, because for us, or at least myself as a driver, on Monday we did 20 laps and then it was rained out again. On Monday I got a clear feeling of what my car was capable of, and I really felt confident about the next day, Tuesday. And but what happened with the at the end of the race, I passed, I think I was in fourth place with about 12 laps to go or so, and then two cars ahead of me had to go into the pits for fuel. So then it was down to me and Scott Goodyear, who was ahead of me leading. I passed him after the restart. And then with 10 laps to go, I think we had three more restarts. And that was really nerve-wracking, because every time there's a restart, you know, you can get gobbled up, especially running in the lead, because the guy in second place has a draft on you and he's actually in a better position sometimes. But when we had the last yellow, I was under the impression that we were going to finish the race under yellow, because normally when you're told, okay, we're going to go green next time by, and they also, the flagman will raise his finger and go, you know, one more lap to go before the restart, but that was never done. And USAC really messed it up and almost cost me a certain victory, because they decided that, well, let's just throw in, you know, a green flag here at the last moment with one lap to go. And as I was coming down the straightaway, I was actually in the wrong gear, because I was at a cruising gear, not in an acceleration gear. I wasn't in second gear, I was in third gear. And then all of a sudden I see the green, and I was very surprised. And when I got on the throttle, the car didn't really accelerate. And I thought, oh boy, here we go. Everybody's going to fly around me on the left and the right because, you know, I was slow off the line. But luckily for me, I wasn't the only one surprised. So everybody was surprised. And luckily the thing got going, and Scott Kuja couldn't get a run on me. And so we finished 1-2. But, yeah, that was a bad moment. Could have been a bad moment.
Well, looking at your two wins, you are the only driver to win at Indianapolis who has a win on either side of the split. Do you see your two wins? Do you remember them in a different light? Do you think of them in a different light when you look back on that?
Well, realistically, you have to. But, you know, I never did because 97, I actually... Like what I just was talking about with that restart and with constantly giving up the lead in the pits and going back to the lead, and Tony Stewart being very strong that day. Buddy Lazier was, again, really strong that year. And Scott Goodyear was in the picture a lot, and he was really strong. And then Jeff Ward became the leader and was running pretty quick. So, you know, there was competition, and I really had to fight for that victory in 97. And when the race was over, I was really, I was really relieved that I was able to pull off another win at Indy after trying so many years. After 1990, I've been, you know, we were competitive many years and in a position to win, but just, you know, something happened. Of course, 96, I was crashed out of the pit lane by Salazar, and that could have been a win there in 90. Two, I was running a strong second behind Michael and had a problem, and then Michael fell out. So there's another race. I was in a good position to win, and I finished third in 91 after losing a lap in the beginning of the race because of a spark plug. And 93, I finished second. And so all these races were, you know, could have, would have, should have. But it just didn't happen. And then, so it was quite a big relief to win it in 97. So, yeah, I was really ecstatic about my win, pretty much as much as the first one. But the first one is always special, of course.
Ari, I want to go back to something you touched upon a little bit earlier when you were talking about the Chevrolet engine you got in 1990. There's certainly a faction of people that say it's much more difficult to win now because with everyone in the same equipment, it really comes down to an engineering exercise and what the engineers do. But on the flip side of that coin, I would offer that you didn't learn how to drive a race car significantly better between 1989 and 1990, but in fact that getting the Chevrolet engine that year was critical to winning. As you said, it's not everything, but it certainly was a very important piece of that puzzle. Looking back at what some people now want to call the last golden era of IndyCar racing back in the early 90s, was it more difficult to win then than what you see the drivers going through now? Or do you think now is more difficult than it was then?
I think it's more difficult to win now for sure. I mean, you know, back then you had a field of 33, but there were definitely the have-nots in there that would, you know, you just knew that that group would never win. And then you had a middle group, and you had a top of the, you know, a top group, you know, Penske, Newman Haas, back then Gallus Racing. But now it seems like the field is so deep that there's only a few teams of which you can say, like, well, those guys, they might not win. But if you look at some of the teams last year, for instance, Alex Tagliani's team really rose to the occasion, was competitive as anybody. And with that small team, what they did against Penske and Ganassi was just phenomenal. It was almost like what we did in the 90s with Shearson Racing against Penske and Newman Haas and those teams, because Shearson Racing was not in the same league as far as a team as Penske, for instance. But at Indy, it all came together, and we were able to pull it off. But I just think that current IndyCar racing is as competitive as it's ever been, the most competitive of, I think, all decades. But you can't always compare decades really so well, but just now because of the cars being so equal, obviously it is more competitive. The differences between, you know, the speeds between the fastest guy of the field and the slowest guy of the field, you know, is becoming smaller and smaller because the equipment is so equal. And that's the same in NASCAR, and it's the same in Formula One. If you look at all the racing across the board, the fields in every form of racing have become so tight. So if you qualify poorly, it could be a problem for you. Or if you have one bad pit stop, it could be a problem for you. And it seems like, you know, 15, 20 years ago, some of these little problems were, you know, you could overcome them. But these days you can't afford to make one mistake because you'll be done. Because it's like they're right there to attack and take it away from you because everybody's so close.
All right, I don't think it's a stretch to say that what Rick Mears was to Indianapolis was in the 80s, you were to Indianapolis in the 90s. And in fact, when we spoke with Eddie Cheever not long ago, he credited you not only for moving his career forward greatly when you were a teammate, but also for really kickstarting Target Chip Ganassi's career there when you were, drove in 92. What was it about your driving style that made you adapt so well to the track at Indianapolis?
Well, that's certainly a nice compliment of Eddie. I remember being teammates with him, and there's certain things that I would do. He goes like, "Wow, you know, how do you do that?" Or, you know, and we would talk about it. But I really don't want to take credit for Ganassi's success. I think Chip Ganassi's done an amazing job with his team, and with the help of Target, was able to move forward in the way he did. But I have to say that. And I was talking to somebody about this the other day. When I went there for the first time in 85, I think the fact that I was actually a little bit, I mean, I was really timid at Indy. I was, you know, almost afraid there a lot of times during that first year in 85. And I think that's what really molded me and made me aware of what it took to go fast at Indy. And what it takes to go fast at Indy is something that I found is that you don't have to be the bravest guy in a race car to be fast at Indy. You need to be smart, you need to understand your car, and you need to have patience. And I'm not saying I've always had that, but most of the time at Indy I've had that. Throughout the course, I think of 18 years, I crashed maybe 5 times and, you know, maybe twice because I messed up myself, but you know, I've seen drivers crash 3 times in a month or 4 times. So I think it takes a lot of patience and understanding your car and then also enjoying the speed. I mean, I did enjoy it, so yeah, I always went to the limit, but I tried to stay right, you know, 0.01% below the limit so I wouldn't go over and crash. So I really wouldn't be able to tell you what makes me different than, for instance, Eddie Cheever or Scott Goodyear. I always did like to run very little wing there, and not everybody wanted to go to that small amount of wing as I did. But, you know, if it feels good to you, but it might not feel good to another. So,
well, you had your practice crash in 2003, and you were not able to qualify for the race because of that. And that was the last Indianapolis that we saw you make an attempt to enter for. Was it that crash that made you hang up the helmet, or was there something else behind it?
Well, I was actually retired already, so then I came back in 1999 was my final 500, and then, of course, like a lot of race car drivers do, they unretire, and then they come back, and I did that too. And looking back, it probably wasn't the best decision I made, but the crash in 2003 was one of those deals too, where I looked at myself and I just explained. I just said, told you about what it takes to be good at Indy,
mm-hmm.
and it's exactly that, you know, that I didn't do in 2003. I wasn't really happy with the car, and I made a mistake. I continued that one lap. I should have not continued it because I didn't follow my senses of what the car was doing. So then when I crashed, I hit really hard, and I really thought that I had broken my back, and I thought I broke something in my shoulders. I mean, the pain was amazing. And I think I made a sensible decision. I went to Dr. Bach at the time, and I said, you know, I might not have broken anything, but I'm in so much pain, and I've had a headache for 4 days, and I just sleep, you know, 12, 14, 16 hours a day. And I said, I'm just not right. And I said, because I'm not right, I'm not going to get back in the car. And that's what I did, because I just didn't feel right physically. And Dr. Bach attributed to, you know, a concussion that just kind of lingered on. And that's what we did. I just told him, okay, then I have to, you know, give up the keys to the car. And Alex Barron drove the car that year, did an unbelievable job. And I think he finished fourth, I think. So, but that was really the end of my career at Indy, because then I realized that, you know, it was time to stop in 1999, and definitely time to stop in 2003 now after this. So, of course, now they got $5 million hanging over that Las Vegas race at the end of the year. I might just have to, you know, reconsider that.
Well, if I was a driver, I would not want you stalking me if $5 million is on the line, whether it's 2011 or 96 or 90 or 86. I wouldn't want to be talking to me.
I can still fit in the cars very well because I'm still pretty skinny. And I'm in pretty good shape. I just probably need to do something about, my vision is good at 20/20 with lenses in or contacts, but maybe I can have that surgery done to my eyes and I'll be good to go.
Well, the $5 million would certainly pay for that.
Oh, yeah.
Have you been in a car since, in a racing car since you called it quits in 03?
Yeah, I actually been driving some historic Formula One cars, which is a lot of fun, but the races are short. And usually at Sonoma or Watkins Glen, and Doug Marquardt, who is a well-known figure in historic Formula One racing, owns a few cars, and he let me drive them. So it was a lot of fun. And I also regularly drive a two-seater Indy car at Indy and at other races as well. So, and it's kind of fun to do. I mean, we're not going around at crazy speeds, but still at good speeds for, at least for the passenger, at good speeds.
Well, Ari, you've had a lot of great memories over your years at Indianapolis. Do you have a memory, a single memory that you could pick out that really sticks with you? And on the flip side of that, do you have one that, you know, still haunts you and you would call it your greatest disappointment?
I think my greatest disappointment at Indy, I mean, 203 was one of the bad moments where I had to, you know, give up the car, but I don't know. No, I haven't really had bad moments. I was very lucky always that I never was injured, but maybe 1999, I think the win in 99 got away. I was leading and I was really, you know, in charge, and I had an incident and crashed in turn three. And I think that was maybe one of the most disappointing races. And the one that stands out is really 1990 at Indianapolis. Being able to win that race at that time, surrounded by pretty much everybody that was important to me, that was pretty cool.
Well, one last question for you, Ari. You are one of only 67 drivers who's earned the right to call yourself an Indianapolis 500 champion. Can you share with us what it means to you to be able to carry that title?
One of 67, huh? Oh, wow. No, I mean, Indianapolis is, when I came over to the United States, that was the race that everybody always talked about. It was the biggest race, and that's what you strive for, is to, first of all, run there and then, you know, drive there and then compete and race and win. To win that, I mean, it's just, you know, phenomenal. It's like, I guess maybe it's comparable to winning the Super Bowl, to winning the World Series, or to be an Oscar winner. I don't know. It's just, yeah. But it changed my life. I have to say, it didn't change me. It gave me, it gave me confidence, for sure, because it does give you that, like, well, you know, nobody can take that away from me ever. So No, it's been great. It's been a great experience to be able to carry that label, and it is a label that you get because, you know, no longer are you just introduced by your name, but it's always, they add that Indy 500 winner to it because, for good reason, because it has prestige and it shows that you've accomplished something. So, no, it's been until the last day I live, I guess it will be cool to have that title.
Well, you've been extremely generous with your time today. We really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us and sharing your memories of Indianapolis, and we look forward to seeing you in May.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun month. I think
all the living
drivers that have raced at Indy are going to be there at one point. It's going to be quite a gathering of special people before the race, so the fans are going to be able to meet us then, and it'd be fun.
And thanks to all of you for listening as well. Please stay with us throughout the month of May as we continue to feature Indianapolis 500 champions in our Centennial Interview Series. And remember that morefrontwing.com is your source online for blogs, photos, podcasts, and more covering the IZOD IndyCar Series and beyond.